The Gemara in Brachos tells us, "Tanurbanan pamachas gazra malchus sarashah shelo yasku Yisrael b'torah." At one point, the evil dynasty made a decree that Yisrael should not be involved in Torah study. This was a time when Rome already ruled over Eretz Yisrael, albeit, I mean, it'd be fully in power, but they were in charge. And they made a decree at a certain point that the Klal Yisrael should not be allowed to be osik in Torah, and the punishment for learning Torah was death. Puppas ben Yehuda one time found Rabbi Akiva, Shemakil Kilas Barabim. Rabbi Akiva was gathering together huge crowds. When Rabbi Akiva would teach, there would be throngs and throngs of people that would come. And he gathered together huge throngs of people in a public place. It was Osik B'Torah. Amalei Akiva, Puppas ben Yehuda said, Akiva, Iyata Mishireh Mipnei Malchus, aren't you afraid of the Malchus? To which Rabbi Akiva answered with a famous mashal. Says Rabbi Akiva, imagine the following. Imagine that a fox is walking by the side of the river, and he sees the fish in the river are gathering and they're jumping from place to place. Says the fox to the fish, why are you running away? What are you afraid of? Say the fish back, there are nets. Men are putting nets into the water. They're going to trap us. Says the fox to the fish, listen, I have an idea. Why don't you come up on dry land? Live with me. Here, we'll be safe together. Say back to the fish to the fox, they call you the Pikeach Shebachayus. They call you the wisest of the animals. You're a fool. If in the place where we live, in the water, we're afraid, surely if we leave the water, how much more afraid should we be? And says Rabbi Kiva, as long as we're involved in Torah study, the Torah says, Ki Chayecha Varach Yamecha, it guarantees us long life. Kavachomer, if we leave Limud Torah, how much more so do we have to be afraid? The Gemara goes on to say, Lo haya yomi mo'otim, it wasn't a long time, until they caught Rabbi Akiva v'chavsu b'beis asurim, and they locked him up in prison. However, they also caught Puppas ben Yehuda, and they locked the two of them together. Amala Puppas, Puppas said, what brought you here? And Rabbi Akiva told him, and he said to Rabbi Akiva, Ashrecha, praise be you, shenifast al divrei Torah, you were caught for learning Torah. I was also caught, sentenced to the same, but for nonsense. And in fact, they decreed that Rabbi Akiva should die. Gemara explains that when they took Rabbi Akiva out to die, it was Man Kriya Shema, and the way that they killed him was not very kindly. They took metal combs and literally skinned him alive, pulled the flesh off of his body. When they were pulling the body, his skin off of his body, he was saying Shema. He was Makabel Malchus Shemayim. And his Talmidim who were watching this said, Rabbeinu Ad Kan, is it humanly possible? Is it humanly possible, explains Rashi, that you could be Makabel Ol Malchus Shemayim, say Shema with Kavana, as they're literally ripping the skin with iron combs off of your body? Amalehem, says Rabbi Kiva back, my entire life I worried about this pasuk. Every day in Shema we say, Hashem, I love you with all of my heart, with all of my nefesh, willing to give up my life. I said, when will I come true? When will I be able to fulfill this? I waited my whole life to fulfill this, and now it comes to my hand that I shouldn't fulfill it. He was Marach Be'echad, and when he got to the end of Shema, at the end of Echad, Yotzo Nishmoso, his neshama left him, a bas kol came out, a heavenly voice came out and said, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva, praise be you, Rabbi Akiva, Shata Muzuman L'chayolam Haba, you are ushered right into Gan Eden, without din, without judgment, you're prepared. And this is the Gemara. And this Gemara is very eye-opening. Because it's true that twice a day we say in Shema, Hashem, I love you with all of my heart. Hashem, I love you with everything, all modecha, everything I have, my money, whatever my valuables may be. And I love you b'chol nafshecha, with all of my nefesh, willing to give up my life. And the Mishnah Brewer brings down that one should envision giving up his life al kiddush Hashem when he says that. And that's something that we think about, something that we should focus on, something that we should be prepared to do. And it should never happen, but halavai, if it does, we should stand up proudly and say, Hashem, I'm willing to give up my life to serve you. That is a Kiddush Hashem. It's a wonderful accomplishment if it has to happen. And in that sense, this Gemara is very logical and certainly makes sense. But the problem is that wasn't what was actually happening. It wasn't just an issue of yes or no. It wasn't an issue of a Nazi saying, will you give up your life or not? That is a very, very difficult decision. Historically, Jews were willing to give up their lives left, right, and center. Josephus brings down that it was a known fact in those days that if you gave a Jew a choice, bow down to idols or lose your life, regularly the Jews would give up their life. And this concept of dying al Kiddush Hashem, as difficult as it is, and again, halavai, none of us should be tested with it, but it is something that historically many, many Jews have accomplished, have reached that great height. But what Rabbi Akiva was doing was very, very different. He wasn't just a yes or no. He was literally being tortured to death. The skin on his body was being peeled off. And whilst that was happening, he was reading Shema with Kavana, and his Talmidim could not believe it. How is it possible? How is it humanly possible that a person could reach that level of control? Says Rabbi Akiva, what do you expect? My whole life I waited for this opportunity. Should I not fulfill it when it comes? And the question that I'd like to ask on this Gemara is, that sounds very noble, it sounds very fine, but what's the answer? How is it possible that a human being could be so in control, so superhuman, that he doesn't cry out in pain, that he's not totally distracted, that he's able to have kavana during Shema while they're literally torturing him to death? And to understand this Gemara, I think we need to better understand the human being a little bit. Mrs. Yaffa Eliach wrote a book called Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust. And this book contains many, many powerful stories of Jews who did heroic acts, and many of the stories are very, very eye-opening. And one story in the book is after the war, when a number of women who had been in a concentration camp was sitting at a bar mitzvah, and the waiter brings by a large bowl of fresh bread and puts it right on the table. And it just happens to be that the women were reminiscing about the war years, which weren't that long ago. And they had been telling stories, and they had been exchanging things. And when the waiter put down the basket of bread, one woman said to the other, do you realize that all of the gold, the diamonds, the jewelry of all the people at this bar mitzvah easily could have been bought for that basket of bread? And that basket of bread was not eaten that day. The waiter took a full basket away as he had put it down. And when you read certain time periods in history, you see that hunger is a powerful, powerful force. Hunger becomes a master. Chazal tell us that it's better to die by sword than to die by hunger. During the Churban Bayis Rishon, many, many Jews died by hunger, and it was considered a horrible, horrible death. And it's not just the death, it's the control that hunger has upon you. Eli Wiesel, in his book Night, writes about a young boy, not so young, but he and his father were traveling in a train, and it was a long train ride that the Nazis were taking them on, and there was no food. And at a certain point, after a week or so in the train, you could hear a man. A man was screaming because another person was beating him. Another man was beating him for the bread that he had. And from underneath, the man who was getting beaten was saying, Mayor, Mayor, you're killing me. Mayor, you're killing your father. Stop it. And you hear stories of people who became driven by hunger to do what we would consider insane things. And yet that's not everyone's reaction. The Kloisenberger Rebbe lived through the Gehenna of those years. And people describe what it was like to watch him. Nobility, regal. When people would be trading their crowns in their mouth, the gold crowns for a slice of bread, he would offer it to people who needed. It was a chesed to give away. He was unaffected by hunger. But more than that, he refused to eat tray food. And someone said to him, Rebbe, we need to, you can die. I don't eat tray food. The man was a malach. One Pesach in the camps, as it was coming close to Pesach, Klonsberg Rebbe stood up and said, anyone who wants may gladly have my bread here. I separate myself from it. And it was mafkir the chametz. But it was mafkir chametz at a time when half of a slice of bread was what kept you between life and death. People would claw, scratch, kill for it. He was mafkir it. And throughout all the years, never once did he lose that sense of nobility. And if you'd like to know how it really was because of a power of will. You see, when you spend your life dedicated to serving Hashem, and when you spend your life in total mastery of the behemah, your will becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. When you have challenges, and every challenge that you've fought, you win. When you have challenges all day long, from morning to night, and despite the challenges, you resist and resist, and despite the challenges, you keep on fighting. And what happens is, your will becomes stronger, you become more the master, and you become the master of the ship. And usually, it's the opposite. Normally what happens is, there's a little whiff of desire or will that pulls a person and he goes after it. And one time it's this feeling, another time it's this feeling. As a matter of fact, if you like to better understand the human, if you imagine a bingo popper, in the good old days, they used to have a wicker basket, and in the wicker basket were many, almost like ping pong balls with the bingo numbers on it, I-19 and B-23, and a man would turn the wicker basket and one of the balls would pop out, and that would be the one that he called B-12. If you imagine that I have within me many, many different midos, many different character traits, there's anger, there's appetite, there's arrogance, there's generosity, there's jealousy. There are many, many different traits. And different things cause these different traits to come out. Some are seasonal, and some are based on situations. But imagine, much like a bingo popper, that they're always coming out. And one time it'll be anger, another time it'll be humility, another time arrogance, another time generosity. But they're always popping out, popping out, popping out. And the question is, do they master you or do you master them? If you spend your life ignoring them and making every decision based on what's right, what's good, what's proper, they become weaker and they don't control you. You become the master of the ship. If you spend your life giving in to every whim and every will, then what happens is quite the opposite. They become your master and they rule over you. If you'd like to understand the answer to Rabbi Akiva, I believe it's really quite simple. And from the time he came to Das, everything that he did was weighed, measured with extreme precision. As an example, the Alter points out, Vayisa es Einav. When the three Malachim were standing way, way in the distance, the Torah tells us that Avram lifted his eyes. And the Alter is bothered by, why does the Torah tell us that Avram lifted his eyes? Obviously, he had to see them. The only way he could see them is by looking. Explains the Alter that no action of Avram Avinu was just happenstance. There was nothing that just occurred. He made a conscious, thought-out decision. It is now appropriate and proper for me to lift his eyes. Vayisa inna vayar. He lifted his eyes upon command. Every action, every thought, every motion of the man was thought out. And the same for Rabbi Akiva. And from the time that he began growing, every action was carefully weighed, carefully measured, with extreme precision. And every single act of his days, of his weeks, were controlled by one single conscious thought. What does the Torah want from me? What's the Ratzon Hashem? And he became a master by his will, of all of the traits, of all of the desires, he became a master of his ship. And now when he was in that situation where they were literally torturing him, there was a huge pull. Something was pulling at him. Pay attention to me, this screaming pain, pay attention. And his rotzon, his will, his neshama said no. And he had practiced that so many times before, ignoring the pull. And so many times before he had strengthened his rotzon, his will, that it was simple for him to ignore it at this time as well. And surely because he said to his talmidim, look, my whole life I waited for this moment. You think I'm going to get distracted by nonsense? The difference between the immature and the mature is often the ability to resist the smallest, simplest temptation. When you give a child a dollar and you send him to the candy store and you know that he might come back in an hour, or he might get distracted, he might come back in 2 hours, or may not come back until who knows when, because something caught his eye, it was a train, a new toy, a bike. A child is highly distractible. But that's because there's a stimuli that occurs to him, and the executive functioning, the ability to say no, and the ability to hold back and ignore it, isn't developed. As you mature, you develop the ability to resist impulses. Rabbi Akiva was at the point where he had spent his life perfecting himself, that no impulse could pull him, and nothing can pull him away. His rotzon was so developed that he literally could go to his death and say, I will ignore the pull because I am the master of the ship. And this is an awe-inspiring example of rotzon, of will, developed to such an extent that it sounds almost supernatural. And it's important to recognize that we will never get there. The Avos, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, the Tanoim, Amorim, maybe, had developed willpower to an extent that it's hard to imagine. We're not obligated to develop at that extent. We'll never have it to that extent. But willpower is a very, very important component in succeeding in life. You see, as we pointed out, the only way a person can change realistically is with a plan. When a person has a plan, a very clear plan, he has a shot at succeeding. And yet, most diets fail. Most attempts at quitting smoking fail. Most attempts at serious change fail. And I'd like to focus on the why. The why is because after you have a very, very good plan, and after it really makes sense, there are three components that are necessary for the success of any person actually implementing that plan. The first is motivation. Motivation is a key factor. You could have the greatest plan in the world. It could be Weight Watchers. It could be low carb. Whatever the plan is, the more motivated you are, the more driven you are, obviously, the easier it'll be for you to succeed. But even if you have a great plan and you're super motivated, you need willpower. Why? Because that chocolate cake is going to look good. The slice of pizza is going to look tasty. The ability to say no, I'm motivated to lose weight, and I have a plan via which I'm going to do it. And yes, there's a pull right now. The impulse is for me to do it, but I will resist. That koach of rotzon, that willpower, is something that's critical. And without it, the best laid plans in the world, the most motivation in the world, and you'll fail. So after you have the plan, you have to have a very good motivation. Number two, you have to have willpower. And there's a third element that will determine success or failure, your emotional self-regulation. Your ability to regulate your emotions, your ability to take control of the feelings and emotions that run through you. You see, you could have a very good plan, and you could have great drive, very, very motivated, and you could even have tremendous willpower. But if you can't control your emotionality, you will fail. One day you'll be up, the next day you'll be down. I'm depressed and down, blah. And it won't matter to you. Your willpower will be useless because you feel like dirt. One day you'll be happy, and next day you'll be furious. And when you're angry, you're going to react in ways that you wouldn't normally act. And you ever watch a man with a temper? And he'll do all kinds of things. and say all type of things that he never would say when he wasn't angry, you're watching a man out of control. You could have all the drive, all the willpower. If you lose control, you're gone. And the ability to self-regulate your emotions, control your emotionality, is the third key to success. And here's the point. All of us have different dosages of each of them. Some people are very, very motivated. Some people aren't. Some people have a lot of willpower. Some people don't. Some people are very balanced, good, solid, wholesome emotionality. Some people aren't. But all of us have each of these in different varying ways. And if you want to succeed after you have a very good plan, after you know what you're doing, you have to work on each of these separately. You have to develop each of them. You have to recognize where they affect you. And you have to learn to develop them, because it's very easy to make a decision to change, but keeping at it is not so easy. And if you read the statistics, what you find is the majority of people never quite make it. Studies show that approximately 20% of the United States population was smokers in 2004. It's hard to get current records because the censuses come out every 10 years, but let's assume that was somewhat accurate. They say that over 70% of smokers want to quit, and 35% attempt to quit each year, yet fewer than 5% succeed. Now, isn't that a Pella? Everyone knows that smoking will kill you. It says so on every pack of cigarettes, every ad that you have out there. In fact, you can't even advertise cigarettes on TV or various venues any longer, because it's considered such an obvious public damaging force that it's no longer accepted to be advertised. There are all kinds of lawsuits against tobacco industry, tobacco companies, for killing people. It's become accepted medical fact that smoking cigarettes will damage your health, will kill you. And yet 20% of the people in the United States of America smoke, 70% of them wish to quit, 35% attempt each year to quit, and only 5% succeed. But why? What's the problem? You have patches, you have electronic cigarettes, you have medicines. There are all types of systems, all types of ways. There's detox, there's psychotherapy, there are many, many systems. And again, as Mark Twain said, it's very easy to quit smoking. I've done it dozens of times. It's easy to quit. It's very difficult to stay quit. And alcoholics have an even lower recovery rate. But you see, this is the reason. Because even after I have a good plan, all three of those ingredients are necessary for me to succeed. Number one, I have to be motivated. And that means I have to constantly re-motivate myself, motivate myself again. I have to focus on what gets me psyched, what moves me, and I have to constantly reinvigorate that. My Rebbe, the Reshiva Zatzal, gave as a tzava, I hear the words ringing in my ear to this very day, you have to learn Musar for 20 minutes every day. What to learn Musar for? I learned many years already. I know these concepts. I speak about them. Because you have to reawaken them, reinvigorate them, and you have to constantly get yourself psyched up again, because motivation comes and motivation goes. And if you're not motivated, you'll fail. Great plan, but if you're not motivated, you're not going to succeed. But even if you're motivated, even if you're really driven, fever pitch, there are going to be tough decisions. There are going to be impulses that come to you. I want the chocolate cake. I want the pizza. I like potato chips. Let me have just one. And your ability to resist and willpower is a key ingredient in success. Even if you're motivated, if you haven't developed willpower, you'll fail. And the third leg of this chair is emotional self-regulation, because once you start feeling self-pity, and once you start feeling like, oh, the world is out to get me, you will crash and burn. And the ability to recognize what are your triggers, and the ability to recognize what causes you to become emotionally dysregulated, emotionally upset or depressed or angry or whatever your poison may be, and your ability to stop those peaks and valleys is again one of the keys that are necessary for success. And I'd like to focus now on the middle part, willpower. And I'd like to share with you that willpower is probably one of the most misunderstood ingredients in the human personality. The Cheshbon HaNefesh, which is a Musa Sefer written by an Achron, a very powerful, very brilliant Musa Sefer, describes Ratzon. He describes willpower. And he says, if you'd like to understand Ratzon, all you need to do is go to a lake or maybe an ocean where there are reeds. If you see tall, tall reeds, you'll watch, as soon as the wind blows, the reeds bend over. The wind blows the other way, they bend over the other way. When the wind stops, they stand where they are. He says those are the various needs, desires, and appetites that affect the Nefesh HaBahami. If you study the baboon, if you study the cow, if you study the orangutan, what you'll find is they're driven by impulses, needs, and desires. Some of those desires are seasonal. A dog will go into heat in the springtime. The baboon will mate in a given time in a given way. The swan will build its nest in the early spring. Once the impulse comes, there's no controlling agent. The impulse comes like a wind that blows the reed. The animal obeys the impulse, the drive, and does accordingly. The Nefesh HaBahami is much like that. There are appetites and hungers and things that will come about seasonally or based on situations. But the key distinction is that the human being has something called Ratzon. And Ratzon is will. Will is the ability to say, you want me to do this now? No, I won't do it. And explains the Cheshbon HaNefesh three chidushim in will. Number one, willpower is like a muscle. It grows or shrinks dependent upon use. Everyone thinks that person has a very strong will. This person has a weak will. It might be true. But the Cheshbon HaNefesh is teaching us that willpower grows. It's like an exercise. It's like a muscle that becomes stronger or weaker based on how much you use it. And if you exercise it, it becomes stronger. Willpower will become stronger and stronger and stronger if you exercise it. And if you don't, it becomes weaker and weaker and weaker. Chiddush number two. Willpower will grow depending upon the intensity of the fight. If you put up a bitter fight and win, your willpower through that fight becomes stronger. If you have a very weak impulse and you win, okay, it's true that your willpower becomes a little bit stronger, but the intensity of the fight determines how much exercise you gain and how much strength you gather through that. But number three is that willpower will grow even if you lose the battle. Explains the Cheshbon HaNefesh, let's imagine I put up a fight, and it's a bitter fight. I don't, and I give in. If I resisted for 2 minutes, 2 seconds, I put up a fight. And if it's an intense fight, and I resisted for 2 minutes, even if I gave in at the end, putting up the fight gave me more strength, exercised that muscle, and it became stronger. And willpower, much like any other muscle, requires constantly strengthening it, constantly focusing on it. And you have to understand that if you don't, it'll be ever weak. And like a weak little muscle, it'll never accomplish what you need. And I'd like to share with you one more concept about willpower that is actually eye-opening. Daniel Goleman, in his book Emotional Intelligence, writes about a study that was done in the 1960s. The author of the study was a psychologist, Walter Mischel. It was done at Stanford University. And the test is now known as the marshmallow test. What they did was they took preschoolers, these are little kids, and they gave them the following challenge. The psychologist gathered these children and told them as follows. I'm going to give you a marshmallow. You have a choice. If you want, you could eat the marshmallow right now. But if you wait until the person comes back into the room, then you're going to get two marshmallows. And each child was put in a room. There were toys and different things in the room. Each child was put alone. And each child was given the marshmallow. and was told, if you wait until the person comes back in, you're going to get two marshmallows. If you don't wait, you'll eat the one and get the one. And they filmed from behind two-way mirrors what was happening. And this is what they found. Almost every preschooler wanted to wait because it sounded like a great deal. All you have to do is wait until the assistant comes back in and you get two marshmallows. And to a little kid, a marshmallow is like the best thing in North America. So they all tried to wait. Some succeeded and some didn't. And you could see the videotapes. You could see some kids put their hands under their legs. And some kids sort of fidgeted, tried to distract themselves. Some kids did this, some kids did that. All the children tried. Some succeeded and some didn't. Some kids ate the marshmallow after about a minute or two. And some kids succeeded in waiting about 4 or 5 minutes. But the final test was 15 minutes in. And a number of children, a small percentage, were able to wait the full 15 minutes. And they got the two marshmallows. Okay, now this is what they discovered. 12 to 14 years later, they re-examined the same children, and this is what they found. And the children who were able to delay gratification, meaning the children who were able to wait the 15 minutes until the assistant came back into the room, were far more socially competent, personally effective, and self-assertive. And what the study proved was that the ability to delay gratification made you a much more effective person and was a tremendous indicator of success. But here's the really interesting point. They found that that group that were able to wait the 15 minutes on average had a higher SAT score by 200 points. Even though on IQ tests there was no difference between the groups, but the ability to resist, the ability to delay the gratification for the 15 minutes made the difference that those who were able to had a 200-point higher SAT score. And the conclusion of the study was that the single greatest indicator of success is the ability to delay gratification more than intelligence, more than IQ. And the reason for it, I guess, is somewhat obvious. You see, when you have to study for a science test, but there's something great on TV that night, or you have a project that's due, but you want to go out and play. Your ability to say no, your ability to say, I have a project that's due, I have a social studies test, and I have a science test, your ability to marshal the energy and do what's incumbent upon you is hingent upon this ability to delay gratification. I'll study now, play later. That ability was the single greatest criteria for success, and more than anything else. And it seems to be a hugely significant criteria for determining success in life. And I guess on some level it makes sense, but here's the most interesting part of the study. These were four-year-olds. That means to say their willpower was inborn. It wasn't something they learned. And the reality is that some people have a healthy, strong dose of willpower. They're very willful people and very strong. They make a decision and they stick to it. And some people aren't. And some people make a decision and 2 minutes later they change. And they want this and they want that and they can't ever reach that strong-willed ability to say no. And you may say, well, we're in big trouble because what if I was one of the kids who ate it after a minute? What if I would have eaten it after 2 minutes? That means I'm cooked. And I want you to understand how severe that would mean. You see, we're not talking about succeeding in one area. Our goal in life is to master ourselves. The Gra explains that the Tachlis Achayim, the reason Hashem created us and put us here, is for us to marshal our energies and master our character traits. By doing that, we become closer to Hashem, we become more like Hashem, we earn our world to come. But the Avodas Hashem is for us to perfect ourselves. That means all of my midos, my anger, my jealousy, my competitiveness, everything is for me to marshal, for me to conquer, for me to become the Adam HaSholem. But here's the problem. If willpower is an essential ingredient, and some people have more and some people have less, it sure doesn't sound fair. But I believe that's exactly what the Cheshbon HaNefesh is teaching us. That you might have started with a weak amount of will. That may be correct. But that doesn't mean it has to end there. In these three areas, motivation, willpower, and emotional regulation, each of us have different strengths or different liabilities, we're stronger or weaker. It happens to be that you must have strength in all of them. If you have one that's a real Achilles tendon, that's really a gap, you're going to fail. But the reality is that each of us will have a little bit more, a little bit less. But the reality is that each of these can change. And just like I can read motivating stories, read inspirational facts, and become more motivated, I can change my willpower, my ability to say no and resist, my ability to delay gratification, my ability to say I'm going to wait the 2 minutes or the 10 minutes or the 15 minutes for the marshmallow. Granted, at age 4, it was at a certain set point, but by exercising it, by saying no, it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, and I can reach a different point. And this is one of the most critical concepts that a person must understand. Because you could have the best coach in the world. You could have the best strategies in the world. But it's you who's in the ring. And you're the one who's in there. And it requires you to say, no, I will not. And motivation is great. Emotional regulation is great. But at the end of the day, it's your ability to say no that will determine your success. Now, again, you don't have to say no every time. You're not going to win every fight. The goal here is not perfection overnight, but your ability to say no more times and more times and more times, to put more distance between the images that come in your brain, to put more distance between the episodes that you're involved in, is the key to growth. And will is at the center of it all, and willpower is something that you need to develop. If you say, I'm a very willful person, I have a strong amount of willpower, so I don't need motivation and I don't need emotional self-regulation, I guarantee you will fail. If you're going to go into this battle with all of the willpower in the world, and even assuming you have a lot of willpower, I guarantee you'll fail. This fight is way, way bigger than willpower alone to conquer. It requires all three. It requires a plan. And it requires tremendous siyata d'shamaya. But the point is, you have to work on all three. And willpower as an ingredient is essential. And willpower can grow. With that being said, I'd like to share with you one of the reasons why so few people in the United States of America today, so few people in Western civilization, can succeed in changing a habit. Whether it's smoking, whether it's weight loss, whether it's drug abuse, why is it that there's such a dismal rate of success? So I believe a big part of the problem is that we live in the Peter Pan generation. And Peter Pan, if you know a little bit of the children stories, he's the guy who wears green, and he floats around, and he's the one who sings the song, I'll never grow up, I'll never grow up, not I. I'll never wear a tie, not on the 4th of July. I'll never grow up, not I. And it's a cute little story and a cute little green guy who says, I'll never grow up. But when you have adults who say the same words, sing the same tune, it's a little interesting. Let me explain to you what I mean. One of the great moral, ethical challenges of the Vietnam War in America was the fact that the draftees were 18 years of age. The boys being drafted into the United States Army to fight in Vietnam were 18 years old. That was the draft age. But at that point in history, you were not allowed to vote until you were 21. And it was a huge outcry. We're old enough to die for our country, but we're not old enough to determine who should make the decisions. We're mature enough to die for it, but you don't trust our maturity to decide who should decide whether we die or not. And this was a huge outcry on the college campuses, and et cetera. And one of the big debates was, when does a person have enough maturity that we could trust his judgment? Is it 18? Is it 21? But there was a certain point that we assumed that a person was an adult and we could trust his judgment. I'd like to share with you that today you don't become an adult at 18, nor 21, nor even at 40. You see grandparents at 65 years of age running around like children. And I don't only mean in shorts and a t-shirt. I mean, playing with toys, acting as juvenile as you can imagine. I'll share with you a little joke. Imagine for a moment the following. You have a child. And at age 7, your child has the maturity of a 3-year-old. It's a very serious issue. You go for counseling. You get help. Imagine this child at the age of 15 has the maturity of a 7-year-old. It's very serious. If at 20 years of age, your child has the maturity of a 12-year-old, you have to seriously consider maybe institutionalizing. Who knows what to say? But what happens when you're 65 years of age and you have the maturity of a 15-year-old? What's that called? That's called retirement. And maybe I didn't say the joke in a way that's funny, but it's not funny. And when you look at the ads and you look at the media's push, when you retire, then you could have fun and you could run around under the sun and do nothing all day but play. And we live in a society that pushes and promotes fun, but not just fun as a distraction or a temporary, fun as a way of life, fun as a total escaping. Happiness is, and you'll fill in the gap with whether it be potato chips or whatever, but if you pay attention to the ads and the themes, what you see is that there's a sense within this country, within Western culture, not to grow up. We're all a bunch of kids, youth-focused, very, very juvenile. And you may say to me, okay, so what's the big crime? It's good to be young. My Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, always had a youth to him. Even when he was 90, he had a huge, huge amount of youth to him. What's wrong with being young? Being youthful is very healthy if you have the maturity that's called upon to make decisions and stick to them. But I'd like to share with you the first thing that goes, and this you'll see in American society, is the ability to say no, the ability to delay gratification. There has become such a pampered, easy lifestyle that you're taught never to say no. I know parents who had a 2-year-old and you were not allowed to say the word no around the child. They didn't want the child to be negative. But that concept becomes so pervasive that you're taught, if you want it, have it. Why wait? You deserve it. You should get it. You can't afford it? Buy it on credit card. Why should you wait? You deserve it. And over and over and over, the culture teaches us, give in, give in. You should have it. Why resist? Why fight? And we become pampered and more lazy, soft, and the ability to say no almost disappears. If it weren't for competitive sports in this country, I don't know if there would be any real challenges that the average high school kid going to public school has. The idea of very strong work ethic that built the United States of America, the idea of perseverance, the idea of thrift, the idea of saving money in the bank. Do you know why this country is in such huge credit card debt? Because it's spend till you drop. And if you can't afford it, you deserve it, get it anyway. And the concept of thrift, of being very careful in your spending, only buying what you could afford and making sure that you put money away, is gone from our culture. And everything that made America great, everything that made mankind succeed, is gone. Hard work, diligence, and delaying gratification for a greater goal, they're all buzzwords of a different century. And America and Western civilization has become such a pampered, soft culture that it's frightening. I'm terrified what would be if, Rahman al-San, there were real tragedies, real difficulties, if there were a war. This is a soft, pampered, very delicate generation. And one of the costs of it is our ability to say no, our ability to delay gratification. You see, if you spend your whole life being told, yes, yes, you deserve it, you should have it, yes, yes, you deserve it, you should have it, well, guess what? You don't exercise willpower. And your ability to say, no, I'm not going to give in. I've never been asked to do that before. I've never been asked to resist. And suddenly you find yourself addicted to drugs or smoking or alcohol or whatever, and now you're fighting a battle. And you're fighting with such wimpy, weak muscles that have never been exercised before. Even if you're motivated, And even if you're emotionally regulated, there's no willpower. You've never exercised that muscle before in your life. You're totally limp. And you can't fight. As B'nai Torah, we have a tremendous advantage. Because it's not just this issue that we have to fight. We fight many battles on many fronts. And we do them day in and day out. And that ability to control our impulses, and that ability to resist, and that ability to be tempted and say no, is something that grows. And we have to understand that all three of these need constant focusing on. This battle will not be won in a day, or a week, or a month, but a big part of it is keeping all three of the legs strengthening and becoming stronger and becoming more powerful. And have to constantly find new motivational material, new reasons to say, I will succeed. I have to work on understanding I'm in this world for a few short years. I'll be there forever in what I shape myself into. That's why we spent a lot of time in these past sessions on discussing that, thinking about it. I have to make sure that I learn to become regulated emotionally, that I don't allow my emotionality to take control of me, because then again, I lose everything. But this middle leg, willpower, is something that requires working. When you read about a Rabbi Akiva who can stand there and being tortured to death, absolutely holds back, does not allow impulses to control him. I am the master of the ship. If I decide to act, I will. If not, I won't. When you read about a Kloisenberg Rebbe thousands of years later, who had what seems like supernatural ability not to be destroyed by hunger, when other men were falling apart at the seams, right, left, and center, right next to him, and he stood there like a powerful beacon, it was because he spent his life developing rotzon, developing a willpower, and when he was tested, it became stronger and stronger. What the Cheshbon HaNefesh is teaching us is that willpower isn't stagnant. If you exercise it, it becomes stronger and stronger. The more intense the battle, the more you have to fight, the more exercise it gets, the stronger it gets. And the third Kiddush is that even if you lose that battle, if you fought for a minute, surely if you fought for an hour, and surely if you fought for a day, your willpower became stronger, even though you caved in. And you lost the battle in the end, but holding back, fighting, pulling, staying strong, strengthened it, and the next battle you'll be stronger, the next battle you'll win. Hashem wants us to succeed. We have the system to succeed. Hashem helps. We take little steps, Hashem blows from behind, pushes us with a huge, huge ruach, but we have to do our part. Our part is to have a plan, to follow the Torah system, and to follow exactly how it should work. And then we have to strengthen each of the areas. We have to strengthen our motivation. We have to strengthen our willpower. We have to make sure that we keep regulated. When a person does that, he changes, he grows. He's not going to win immediately, but the more he does it, the stronger he becomes. The stronger he becomes in all areas. And eventually he reaches a point where these things no longer control him, but he controls them.